The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Science Weekly with me, Alok Jha. I'm outside Imperial College London and I'm here for the 6th International Meeting of Synthetic Biology. The number 6 tells us that this science is at the very earliest of stages and that the debates and presentations going on at this conference are the very foundations of a subject that will have profound long-term impacts on our health, on our environment, and how we see the role of scientists in society. So, where else would you rather be? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The meeting's been organised by the BioBricks Foundation, which is a really interesting international group of synthetic biologists. Now, the best way for me to describe them is to take a quote from their website. They call themselves, quote, a public benefit organisation founded in 2006 by scientists and engineers who recognised that synthetic biology had the potential to produce big impacts on people and the planet, and who wanted to make sure that this emerging field would serve the public interest. Which is all admirably public-spirited. At Imperial College, the local organisers include the titans of the UK synthetic biology community, and they're not only here to talk about public benefit, but also business.
Okay, I'm Paul Fremont. I'm the co-director of the Centre for Synthetic Biology and Innovation at Imperial College London, and I'm also co-hosting the SB6 meeting.
And I'm Richard Kitney, and I'm the other co-director of the Centre for Synthetic Biology and Innovation, and also a co-chair on the conference.
So guys, tell me why the conference is at Imperial this year. This is a very big sort of event in this world. How did you get them to host it here?
Well, there's a simple answer to that question, yeah. Which is that we are arguably the leading centre for synthetic biology in Europe. And, you know, maybe along with ETH in Zurich, yeah. But, you know, we're a leading centre. And so, therefore, the BioBricks Foundation were very keen to hold the meeting here, and we were very keen to hold it.
Yeah. So, Paul, it might be worth introducing what the BioBricks Foundation is. Are they the sort of the keepers of the keys for synthetic biology?
I wouldn't go as far as saying that, but I think they're a very, very, very good organisation that have been set up to try and make synthetic biology open, to make it transparent and to essentially allow a community to build biological parts and share them openly with each other and prevent any sort of roadblocks or any intellectual property roadblocks or any other things. They're really a non-for-profit organization trying to promote almost the you know, democratization, if you like, of synthetic biology.
And they're named after this unit of synthetic biology, the BioBrick. Dick, can you explain what one of those is?
Yes, so a BioBrick is what I would describe as a standard piece of DNA. This standard piece of DNA goes into what's called a registry, which is essentially a database, and those BioBricks are put together to form longer sections of DNA, which when inserted in a cell, cause the cell to respond. The term BioBrick, it might be worth saying, was coined by Tom Knight from MIT about 10 years ago. Yeah.
And you've already talked about Britain, sort of the Imperial's role in this. How does Britain stack up in synthetic biology around the world? I mean, a lot of the people we've spoken to here tend to be from Stanford or from Johns Hopkins University, yeah. Or from Harvard. Sure. There's a huge contingent of Americans, yeah. Here.
Well, no, there is a huge contingent of Americans, and there is a huge community in America. I mean, they've actually got a bit of a head start. They've been, you know, doing synthetic biology since 2000, pretty much, and building capacity and intellectual capacity in that area. So the UK, so Dick and I started working really around 2005, probably
2003. We started
2003,
we're serious work in 2005.
Yeah. So and then you know and then we were just two of us, and now we've got a centre with you know 10 PIs and 50 researchers. But you know. The UK is just sort of trying to, you know, it's just sort of on that catching up phase, actually. Yeah. But having said that, what's really great about the UK is that there's enormous alignment between the funders, the academics, and industry, and some of the policymakers and some of the other areas, which is unusual. And the Americans find that very interesting and hopefully slightly scary.
Well, yeah, and sorry, you know, I was going to say what's important, probably the stress is, In terms of academic synthetic biology, which is really what it's mainly about at the moment, we're second only to the United States. The UK is second only to the United States. And in a way, why there are so many Americans here is because it's a joint meeting between the BioBricks Foundation and Imperial College, so they naturally draw in a lot of Americans. Yeah.
Now, you've said that it's only been around a decade that you guys have been doing this at Imperial, but in that time, as you've intimated, it's grown hugely, and to the extent where government is now coming to you with money. David Willetts was here, the science minister. What was he talking about here?
Well, he's actually announced this morning a new centre of synthetic biology here at Imperial, which is called a Knowledge and Innovation Centre. We were fortunate enough to win a national competition for this centre, and the centre, the IKC as we call it, is all about industrial translation. So it's about taking science from the lab and getting it into industry, working in collaboration with industry. And we are leading an overall consortium of which we put together of 17 universities around the UK to do this.
I think it's fair to say that the IKC is industry inspired, and the idea is that you can bring the academic base, if you like, to bear on industrially led sort of problems in synthetic biology. And I think that's going to be very powerful in the UK.
I mean, everything from that new initiative to the name of the centre that you already head up, which has the word innovation at the end of it. I mean, normally scientific institutions don't have that. It seems very industrially led, seems very sort of commercially driven to some extent. Is that a hard sell to academic scientists who often just want to be left alone to look at molecules and things in test tubes?
No, I don't think so, because synthetic biology is a science which is aiming to achieve particular solutions to particular problems. And therefore, if it's an application-driven science, the natural endpoint of any application will be some type of commercialization, some type of utility for society in general. So in some ways, I don't see that as a problem. I mean, I think there's so much academic research to be done in synthetic biology as well to enable the tools to allow us to do some of the applications. So I think there's some great space for everyone in this field.
But also, you have to think about what synthetic biology is. It's the bringing together of biology and essentially engineering. So in the culture of engineering, engineers, you know, right from when they're undergraduates, are taught that the whole point of doing work is to get it out into industry, to get it out into society. So that's why there's a big drive to get these things out in society. Plus the fact that within the Imperial College Charter 1907 and then reinforced in 2007 when we became a university in our own right, there is the imperative to get the science into industry, work with industry, to boost the economy.
So do you see a lot of entrepreneurship amongst synthetic biologists? I mean, maybe more so than you see in other basic sciences.
Yeah, we were at this event last night called SymBioBeta, which was an American kind of startup forum, if you like, but they had it here as part of the event, part of the meeting, the festival we're having. And there was a whole pile of UK startups that did all two-minute pitches. And they're very exciting, very, very exciting stuff, you know. So that entrepreneurship and that spirit, you know, it's just not US only. We have a lot of it here, and a lot of young people are very excited to do it. So it's a very interesting phase, I think.
Yeah. Dick, I've heard you talking about synthetic biology as a sort of industrial revolution for this century. I mean, people always talk about industrial revolutions, but I mean, it's not an overkill to say that, is it?
No, I really do not believe it is an overkill to say that. And the reason is because, you know, about 2000, with the initial sequencing of the human genome, a whole series of additional technologies sort of came to fruition. I mean, they've been developing over 20 years, but the ability to be able to sequence DNA rapidly and to now synthesize DNA is a key driver in terms of synthetic biology. And that just didn't exist before. And now what we have is a situation where there are large industries. I mean, Siemens is an example. PerkinElmer is another example, where this is a major part of their industrial activity to produce instruments which allow you to do the sequencing rapidly, to do the synthesis rapidly, actually at very low cost.
I mean, I think Dick's right. I think the whole key point here, the innovation that's happening is the ability to synthesize DNA. So we've learned how to read DNA over the last 20 years, and some in and now. It's I know it's slightly cliche-driven, but we are learning how to write it now. And I think it's this writing phase which is really exciting, driving all of synthetic biology. It's what are we going to write? How are we going to write it? How are we going to put it together?
There is also, though, sometimes a problem with exciting technologies like yours about a bit of hype. Do you worry about the fact that when people like Craig Venter come along and say they've created life forms, that takes away from the sort of the more sort of real stuff that you're doing?
Of course it does. Yeah, I mean, I think it. You know, I think the field is maturing. I think if you at the SB6 conference, I personally have not seen any hype. I've seen some amazing science actually beginning to achieve results. I haven't seen anyone pretending that that's what's going to happen in the future. It's happening now. And I think you know, the hype might have been a few years ago, and maybe that was part of the field, you know, a little bit immature, growing up, and now it's maturing into a very, very powerful field that's actually delivering things. I mean, you know, that you just got to go to the talks today.
Yeah, and I mean, you could, if you're being slightly cynical about new fields in terms of science and technology, say there needs to be a hype phase to get it going.
Yeah.
Okay. The reason there's no hype here at the conference is because a lot's happening. You know, there's a lot of very good science going on. There's a lot of very good collaboration with industry. You don't need hype anymore.
Well, in that case, then give me a hype-free tour of maybe some of the things you've seen that you've really been surprised by or enjoyed. I mean, I know that as organizers of conferences, it's very hard to enjoy what you're doing in the conference, but have there been things you think, oh, that's really interesting?
Yeah,
I love that.
I'm going to get in first here because Paul would do this. For me, the presentation on fashion and the application of synthetic biology to haute couture and producing materials. I thought that was really excellent.
What was that? I'd like to know. I'm curious.
Well, it's all about actually secreting cellulose and bacterial cellulose and how you can use bacterial cellulose to produce actually a whole series of different types of materials, products. And so this was couched in terms of fashion, haute couture. And so the presenter showed how you can produce different types of materials. I mean, it's in a relatively early stage at the moment, but also leathers, you know, artificial leathers, etc.
Yeah, no, this is the work of Suzanne Lee. Yeah. And so Suzanne has been, you know, working for many years on this idea of biocouture, this sustainable, you know, fabrics, because, you know, cotton is a very unsustainable fabric. And she's done some proof of principle, so she's made some garments with bacterial cellulose. I mean, it's very early days, and it's not something you can just sort of, you know, it's going to be manufacturing. But the point is, she's showing that there are alternatives.
Well,
that are more sustainable.
You get the bacteria to make the raw ingredients, then you use normal tailoring to make the clothes.
Yeah, well, it's slightly more different than that, because actually the material itself, you don't necessarily sew it, you dry it over shapes, and it's got seamless things. And she made some beautiful jackets, made a shoe. As a sort of the extent of the robustness, a shoe needs to be incredibly strong. It was a great talk. Actually, in the meeting, there was a great buzz after it. In fact, all our American colleagues were blown away by it, because they couldn't, you know, I don't know whether it's something about London or the UK or whatever, but bringing that crossover into this scientific meeting blew them all away.
One of the headline announcements from this year's meeting was the launch of an international collaboration to create a synthetic yeast. Now, why yeast, you might ask? Well, it turns out yeast is a highly useful microorganism, and along with being responsible for two of our most beloved foods, bread and beer, a synthetic yeast would be a useful platform for biological engineers.
All right, so I'm Tom Ellis from Imperial College, and I'm here to talk about joining the synthetic yeast project, where we're going to build a yeast genome as a consortium, and Imperial College are going to build one of those chromosomes up from synthetic DNA and make the whole chromosome through.
And my name's Leslie Mitchell. I'm from Johns Hopkins University, where the Synthetic Yeast Genome Project, I guess, arose originally. I've been working on this for the last couple years, and I've built one of the synthetic chromosomes, and we'll be working closely with Tom and other groups around the world as we continue this project.
Now, why would we want to build a synthetic yeast? What's the sort of purpose of it?
All right, well, reason one might be because we can. It'd be interesting to see if we can develop the tools to build up a synthetic yeast genome. Maybe those tools can then be used in other ways. But then I guess the more important reason is you can learn from building in synthetic biology. So by putting things together in a way that we think by engineering, we can then see if those things work biologically, and that might help us learn how biology naturally evolves genomes, things like the layout of a genome and the essential genes required for a genome. So by building up, we might learn a lot about biology.
So does this mean that you can do experimental evolution or something? If you create this thing, you can watch these things move around and evolve and that kind of thing. Is it a basic science, or is it eventually going to be a vehicle for more practical applications?
Right, so the design of the chromosomes, which Leslie's been part of, includes some interesting modifications which will make this yeast do tricks that normal yeast and normal genomes can't do. And one of those is recombination, so the ability for essential genes to be maintained, but non-essential genes to perhaps be deleted or moved around to other places in the genomes. And we call this the scramble system. That's right, Leslie?
That's correct.
And the scramble system allows the whole genome to kind of be shuffled around, so the genes of the genome, which give it its function, can then be moved around to different places in the genome or deleted out.
Now, Leslie, you said you built one of these genomes before. How did you go about starting that, even?
It starts with the design process. So to be clear, we're not simply remaking the known yeast genome, we're actually rewriting it with all these features Tom has described. So we design it in silico, so in the computer, and then we outsource the production of DNA either to gene synthesis companies or at Johns Hopkins. We've actually engaged the undergraduate community in a really interdisciplinary course called Build a Genome, where undergraduates come together in class and learn how to build synthetic pieces of DNA. And then those become the building blocks for introduction into yeast to build these chromosomes. So it's
And so how long did it take to build the first one?
The first chromosome was actually full-length chromosome, was synthetic chromosome 3, built in-house at Hopkins through the efforts of undergraduates to build up 270 kb synthetic DNA that was then integrated into yeast by two postdocs named Heloise Mueller and Vishu Anuluru. And that took on the order of a couple years. So that is a time frame that's much reduced when we outsource the production of the DNA to companies. And that takes just a couple months, depending on the size and length of the chromosome, of course.
I was going to say, can you give us a sense of how much 270 kb, that's 270 kilobases, right? Thousands of base pairs. In a human genome, there's 3 billion base pairs. They're considerably different size things. How fast can you get it now?
So the yeast genome is 12 megabases in size. So you can imagine that a megabase is 1,000 times more than a kilobase.
So a million. A million base pairs.
Correct. And so the longer chromosomes will obviously take longer. We're looking at finishing this project in the order of 3 to 5 years.
So once the project is finished and you have this synthetic yeast, and you can study, you know, as you say, all of the sort of basic biological processes. Would it also be useful as a platform for all the things we hear about that synthetic biology is going to do for us, you know, energy technologies and drugs and all those things?
Right. It really will be a useful platform, because not only will we know more about it as a platform organism because we've built it, but it also has all these extra features in it that make it be able to do new functions. So one of the features that's been engineered into the whole genome is the ability to have one of the 64 codons of life not present in the entire genome, so that instead we can reprogram the production of proteins so that they can add in new amino acids into proteins in a predictable way.
So just explain what a codon is for us.
Okay, yeah. So a codon is 3 bases. So we were talking about millions of bases, but actually what encodes an amino acid, which is what builds up proteins, is coded by 3 bases of DNA, and that's a codon. The whole of nature uses 64 codons to encode 20 amino acids, but by re-engineering and rewriting the whole genome, we can free up one of those 64 and use it to encode a 21st amino acid. So that will add new chemistry wherever you want it in any protein in the entire yeast genome. So you can start thinking about making enzymes that have new catalytic abilities that have never been seen before in nature because they contain these new amino acids. You can think about building up therapeutics, all sorts of crazy things.
And the thing is, how do you start to work out what these new amino acids will do? I mean, it's very, very complex. I mean, protein chemistry is a subject by itself that's been going on for a long time. So how do you start to think, okay, well, we want this protein to do this, and therefore the DNA code must be like that? I mean, it sounds like a lot of steps.
Right, but some other people at SB6 conference have presented some some presentations this week talking about putting in an amino acid, something like an amino acid which is activated by light into proteins in specific places. And they can kind of predict that that will have certain properties that you can change when you then hit that protein with light. So there's a lot of work going on in the chemistry sphere and has been going on for about 10 to 15 years that really will influence what we do with the synthetic yeast when it's done in that space.
Leslie, why yeast in the first place? I mean, for most people, it's something you make bread or beer with. So it's very common. But why have you chosen yeast to sort of do this very cutting-edge technology with?
Right, that's a great question. It's a very tractable organism. The genome sequence is actually the first genome sequence of eukaryote known. So we've annotated the genome. We know what's there. We know, for the most part, what most of the parts of the genome do. And so it becomes this really well-established model organism that we can manipulate easily. And I think that's the key point. It's easy to change the DNA in yeast. It's called homologous recombination, and you can swap pieces of DNA easily. And that's exactly what we're doing in our project, taking out the wild-type native sequence and putting in the synthetic sequence. It's an organism that we know and love, and it's easy to work with. Those are some great reasons.
So scientifically speaking, it's kind of controllable and understandable and stuff. And what I'm kind of wondering is, when you do make this the synthetic yeast and you have it programmed for a particular function, say, would you be able to brew it and grow it that way? I mean, you don't need anything particularly complicated to grow this stuff, surely, after that.
So the synthetic yeast is based on a lab strain of yeast. And sure, it can do brewing and it can produce ethanol. But it's nowhere near as good at doing that as the ones that are used in the beers that we know and love, because those are sort of much wilder and have much larger cells.
You're destroying my image of a synthetically produced beer here.
Right, but because we can shuffle the genome, and it has this designed-in ability to shuffle the genes around, maybe even some duplication might occur as well as deletion, you might be able to then select for new versions of the genomes where things have shuffled around that produce larger and larger amounts of ethanol. And the way you would do that experiment would be to induce, so turn on the shuffling system in increasing concentrations of ethanol, and only the yeast that survive and keep producing more ethanol would be the ones that are left at the end of this experiment. And so those ones then, you could then take them and see, is that repeatable? Do they start to produce more and more ethanol in higher yields?
Tom, I've heard you talk about this in terms of microbreweries all over the place. People having microbreweries of whatever synthetic biology organism, producing whatever they want. A bit like, you know, craft beers, but sort of craft pharmaceuticals or something.
Right. So because we're working with yeast, there's a massive industry out there who already know how to work with exactly the same organism, S. cerevisiae yeast, at really large scales. And they're the brewers, right? So you can have the huge brewers, like out in West London, or smaller brewers here. And that sort of technology and that know-how could easily be then translated to saying, well, a microbrewery will have a lot of the expertise and equipment to instead turn into somewhere that can make products out of yeast, out of synthetic yeast, out of synthetic biology. And actually, we're already seeing companies like Amaris in the US making yeast as their main organism, because that's this experience of brewing yeast for beer, which can now be changed to brewing yeast for things like therapeutics.
The potential for this technology has been much talked about in recent years. By engineering biology, we'll be able to use nature's sophisticated toolkit, which has evolved over billions of years, to engineer everything from drugs to fuels, and to put computing logic into biological organisms. The people at the coalface, however, know that there's still a lot to learn about the basic biology before you can properly manipulate it.
My name is Farron Isaacs. I'm a bioengineer by training and from Yale University, where I'm part of the Molecular Cellular Development Biology Department and Systems Biology Institute there. And the focus of my lab is really working at the interface of synthetic biology, genomics, and biotechnology, where a lot of our work is centered around developing and enabling technologies for genome engineering and cellular engineering, and applying them in one respect to gain deeper insights into the basic biology of how systems work and deciphering biological complexity, as well as then leveraging those insights towards engineering new function into organisms.
So can you give me an example of the kinds of work you've been doing?
Sure. So a lot of what we do is we'll develop technologies such as MAGE, multiplex automated genome engineering, or CAGE, conjugative assembly genome engineering, really with the goal of being able to drive large-scale genetic modifications across organisms. And here we can effectively reprogram organisms by converting them into factories for producing new types of fuels or drugs or chemicals or even materials, as well as creating new genetic codes. And all of this was the topic of my talk here. And we're really excited about organisms with new genetic codes because we think that's going to lay the foundation for really organisms that are going to impart entirely new properties or really orthogonal biological properties. So some examples are we're going to basically create organisms that are going to be resistant to viruses. So that could have immediate implications in biofermentation and possibly broader as we be able to develop these capabilities in other organisms. And it's also going to allow us to effectively expand the chemical repertoire of proteins by really being able to efficiently encode new synthetic amino acids.
So the two techniques you just mentioned at the beginning there, CAGE and MAGE, let's talk a little bit about what those are, how they differ from what, you know, our listeners might be already familiar with. Genetic modification, we're kind of familiar with the idea of changing a gene or various things to make sure that a new organism produces a different amino acid or a protein or something. The techniques you're talking about are much more large scale across a whole genome. Can you just explain the difference?
More traditional genetic engineering techniques really allow you to make sort of single changes in an iterative way. And you can think about MAGE and CAGE as sort of like genetic engineering on steroids, where you can really just, really, I like to think about turning the genome into clay. You could really be able to mold new changes at large, unprecedented scales. So you can think about it as really sampling vast genetic landscapes, and that will allow you to really quickly engineer organisms with entirely new properties. And that's really the major breakthrough.
And we talk about synthetic biology a lot and the applications of which, and you mentioned some of them, you know, new energy technologies, harvesting sunlight to make fuels, for example, or as a way to make drugs. I mean, all of these things will, when you reprogram a bacterium or anything else to do these things, you need to do lots and lots of changes in the genome. It's not just a single point thing, and that's where your technique comes in.
Yeah, and in many respects, biology is so complex that the knowledge we have about any biological system is really still at its infancy. And so therefore, you know, we will work with what we've got, but we also need to develop and employ methods that allow us to really sample combinatorial types of genetic space as a way to really search for many solutions to the problem. And once we find those solutions, we can then circle back and identify the genetic basis or the biological basis that leads to that. So not only can we achieve the function that we're desiring, but it's also going to enhance our understanding of the basic biology as well.
Okay. Can you give me a couple of examples of maybe practical applications you're working on? I mean, the stuff we've been talking about so far is techniques, but yeah. Are there specific applications you are kind of fond of?
Sure. So we're really excited about working in our recoded organisms for a few reasons. One is it's going to allow us to really produce new types of proteins, enzymes, or even biopolymers that will form the basis of new types of materials that don't exist in nature, new types of therapeutics. And that's all really allowing us to really merge biology with synthetic organic chemistry. That is most exciting to me. Similarly, we can use these organisms, as I mentioned before, that are going to be resistant to viruses. And that's very powerful because a lot of the industry basis behind this is rooted in biofermentation. And if you can basically use organisms that are going to be resistant to virus contamination, which really compromises biofermentation processes about 15 to 20% of the time, you could really solve some major problems there. And then you think further about engineering biological containment. There's a number of incredibly powerful things you could really use from an organism that's been recoded. So to me, that's most exciting.
How far can this go? I mean, can you, if you have an understanding of the genetics and a way to program essentially lots of parts of its genome. Could you, for example, look at the genome of a pathogenic virus and create a vaccine or something like that?
I think that's certainly something that can happen in the future, yes. You know, it's, again, it's non-trivial, but I think, you know, we're heading in directions along those lines.
Now, a lot of the stuff we talked about, when we talk about synthetic biology, you talk about chemistry, there's biology in there, there's definitely engineering principles.
Sure.
Which one of those disciplines do you see yourself part of?
Well, by training, I'm a bioengineer, but, you know, my training is broad. So, I mean, I've got a lot of training in biology and engineering and chemistry and mathematics.
Do you also need all those science. Things to do this?
I would say you definitely need to have a interdisciplinary skill set. All of those things, no. It's hard for any one person to have both breadth and depth and knowledge across all those fields. But I think you definitely need to be trained to think and be able to execute on interdisciplinary skills.
Now, we're at Synthetic Biology 6, and this is the sixth conference in this area.
Yes.
And that, in scientific terms, means it's a brand new science. So what do you think the big challenges are for your field in terms of how you move forward with it?
It's a very good question. I think there are a number of challenges. I think there are both scientific challenges and societal challenges. I think scientifically, you know, we're really just at the beginning of engineering biology and developing the enabling technologies to do so. And so there's still tremendous challenge in really developing the foundational technologies to engineer organisms. But what's also equally as challenging is really, you know, applying those technologies to, you know, the killer apps. What are the challenges in society that we want to address? You know, so you hear about fuels, you hear about drugs, but actually bridging those gaps is incredibly challenging. So it's both finding the way to you know, develop that hammer and finding all the nails out there that you want to hit. So I think it's exciting, and I think ultimately we're going to get there. But it's going to take time, some investment, and patience, as well as a society who's going to really welcome these kinds of changes. I think it's very exciting. You know, I tell the students in my lab and the students that I teach at Yale that, you know, we're transitioning from the century of, you know, chemistry and physics and information sciences to the century of biology that's really going to build upon all of those previous advances. And so I think it's going to be very exciting.
Do you think much about how the members of the public who are not scientists might perceive some of the technologies that you're developing? I mean, genetically modified foods and things have caused lots of problems in the UK, at least, maybe not in America. And this is kind of, synthetic biology is essentially GM on steroids, really. So do you think about acceptance from the public?
Sure, yeah, that's a big concern. And it's something that I think really can be addressed by engaging the public and educating them properly, because there's so much more to gain by engineering biological systems and producing GMOs in safe ways that are really going to benefit society in ways beyond our current imagination. And so I think it's really a matter of the public being educated and comfortable with the fact that we've already used GMOs in the past for many medicines that we take or foods that we eat or products that we use. And I think it's important that we embrace that.
Walk around this meeting and everyone's talking about the public perception of their subject. Will this bright new future be palatable to people who aren't scientists in the field? It's important, of course, because it'll be the non-experts around the world who create the laws, the regulations, and who will eventually buy the products. As well as thinking about bringing synthetic biology to the real world, by education, as Farron Isaacs has already mentioned, a small group at the meeting are trying to bring the real world crashing into the lives of the scientists. Alexandra Daisy Ginsberg is an artist and designer who's interested in how synthetic biologists intend to engineer the world around them. Her goal is to make scientists think harder about how they intend to design nature.
That's a really good question. What is this fear that they suspect the public has. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion saying, well, if only they understood, they'd like it. Well, why? I mean, why is that the assumption? Maybe this isn't a good technology, or maybe parts of it are good and parts aren't. So to assume that there is this need and this drive that we have to have it, I think is a problem for the field that needs to be addressed. The idea I often say at these conferences, like, you're promising us a disruptive technology, but you're also promising to disrupt nothing. And you can't have both ways. We're going to make, you know, 10 fields of sugarcane into food to field bugs so we can fly in planes. Nothing is changing. And really, we need to be addressing, why are we flying in planes so much, or how do we find ways to, you know, to use less fuel or alternatives to fuel? So a lot of this discussion is this fear of, you know, the public clamping down on the research, but I think that those other kinds of discussions, you know, the societal risk in terms of society saying, well, we don't want to do this and we don't trust, and those are the questions that science and synthetic biology also needs to not be scared of engaging with.
When people think about synthetic biology, we're thinking about designing DNA and so on, but it's not designed in the with the capital D sense that it might exist in the real world, but you're trying to bring some of that in, are you?
I think that every presentation in this whole conference uses the word design multiple times, and a lot of synthetic biologists even see themselves as designers. But there's a very different definition, you're right, of what I see as design. For me, design is about engaging kind of at a human scale with the world. But then what's unusual about synthetic biology is these scientists and engineers are saying that they're going to design applications. And then, well, what are those applications and how do they sit in the world? And that's been, for me, the really interesting part, is saying we can't just think about it at DNA scale and at the same time start discussing the world as this outside place and all these, you know, this humanity that it's going to save. Who are these people and what do they actually want from a technology?
And so how do you work with scientists then? Can you give me an example of a project or a particular application of your work, the design stuff, with some biologists?
So my work has taken, I'm always experimenting with different ways of collaborating. There's been working with iGEM teams, so that's the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition, where students design cool bacteria to do stuff using the BioBrick standard, to working sort of in a more, trying to find out different ways to bring scientists into artist studios, for example, or laboratories. So the Synthetic Aesthetics Project was funded by the National Science Foundation, the EPSRC, and with the specific aim to actually open up these questions that are unusual in the laboratory, like, what does it mean to design nature and how would you design it well? So we brought artists and designers into collaborations with synthetic biologists from lots of different areas of the discipline, and they worked in collaborations, working, spending time in the lab, but also spending time in the artists and designers' studio, like crashing different ways of working and thinking together and doing things that there's not normally time for in science, which is to ask why and what and how might we do this differently. And the projects that ensued range from everything, sort of redefining what a bacterial computer is, so trying to take the logic from a whole cell rather than trying to program the DNA to make the computer, and then actually extracting, using algorithms, you know, extracting the data from that cell to then solve spatial problems, to making cheese out of human body bacteria. So that's...
I didn't want to ask this, but I'm going to, I suppose, which is, there is that sort of slightly... To use a phrase we just talked, a cheesy sort of element to some of this stuff. Sometimes the collaborations between design and science and art and science can result in some odd things.
The reason that the Human Cheese Project, which actually has a different name, the Inside Out Body, is...
Can you explain what the Human Cheese Project actually is?
So what we... As part of Synthetic Aesthetics, we paired a biologist, a synthetic biologist, Christina Agapakis, with a smell provocateur, Sissel Tolas. So she's based in Berlin and she works with smell. That's her medium. And she thinks that in her practice that we need to not just think of the world in terms of good and bad smells, that there's this sort of increased antibacterial, pasturation, anti-bad smell culture that we live in. And in a way, synthetic biology is feeding into that. The human body is covered in bacteria. We're increasingly understanding how much we actually rely on them to survive. I think like 2-4% of our body weight's bacteria. And they started looking at cheese. So like Limburger cheese smells of feet because it's the same bacteria on the cheese as on your feet. So they started to ask, this was in the Silver Lab at Harvard Medical School, can we actually make cheese out of human bacteria? And yes, that's how cheese is made. People are arm deep churning curds. And so they decided, well, we'll just swab people. And I unfortunately was in the way at the time and managed to get swabbed myself. But this cheese that they made out of philosopher's toe, there was Daisy's armpit, Sissel's nose, there's a variety of different human cheeses.
I don't know if I want to ask this, but what does Daisy cheese taste like?
Luckily, it was judged by an expert panel to be the best smelling. So...
what does that say?
I don't know what it
says. Are you pleased?
Because I have to talk about it so much, yes. I think if it smelled like philosopher's toe, it would be a sad thing. But the reason, although it sounds gross, is actually there are scientific elements to their project as well. But on the sort of from my point of view, what's so interesting is that it challenges these sort of basic assumptions in synthetic biology. Like, we are what we eat, but in this future, it may be that we eat what we are.
Synthetic biology comes, of course, from the study of natural systems. But in their race to perfect biology, do the high-tech engineers and molecular experts we've heard from sometimes forget that where there's DNA or protein, there might once have been a living thing? Kent Redford is a conservation biologist and a former vice president at the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York. He's keen to remind colleagues at the conference about the nature part of the work they're doing.
My name is Kent Redford, and I am a conservation biologist who has discovered the field of synthetic biology, which is largely unknown within my own field. And what I have found has been alarming and exciting to me at the same time. And I'm on a mission to try to get my field to learn and work with the synthetic biology community and in a parallel fashion, to get synthetic biologists to start thinking about the natural world as an object that they should be paying attention to, both in terms of the impacts that they may have on it and also the responsibilities they have towards it.
Is this something that synthetic biologists don't think about very much or at all?
In my experience, they largely haven't thought about it at all. It's just never occurred to them.
But when you say they should be thinking about it, what do you want them to do?
There are two main thrusts of what I would like them to do. The first is to take responsibility for the role that the natural world plays in providing them with inspiration and with what amounts to raw material through the use of genes from wild species. And then the second is to help us develop ways to make the world a better place for the non-human species that live here. And in particular, there are a set of intractable problems that are facing the conservation community for which we have run out of any options. And one of them is the rapid diminishment in numbers and extinction of amphibians due to fungal diseases. We just don't know what to do about it. We're just watching them disappear. And this is something that I would be very excited to see synthetic biologists take an interest in, to see whether they could use some of their techniques to develop a way to fight this fungus and prevent these frogs from going extinct.
So going further than that, is there opportunities for this sort of technology to be used to bring species back from extinction or from the brink of extinction?
Yes, and there is a group called Revive and Restore that is working on this area that they call de-extinction to recreate extinct species, which for me is a worthwhile effort, but only if it serves as a way of attracting the attention of the public to this larger set of issues, which have a much broader impact on the fate of the natural world.
So when it comes to the conservation biologists, what do you want them to know about this potential technology? And kind of what are you concerned about in terms of the stuff that synthetic biologists are producing already?
I want them to know the existence of the field and the potential, the actual and potential things that are going on in synthetic biology. My experience so far has been it largely is very startling and alarming to the conservation community because of really the complete lack of interest in the natural world on the part of synthetic biologists, yet their deep reliance on it. So one, I want to educate the conservation community, and two, I would like them to learn about synthetic biology to the extent that they can be engaged in collaborative work to try and develop some of these potential solutions, one, and two, to think about the impacts of the research before it's conducted and to try to create an approach which is more sensitive to environmental impacts.
So do you mean actually having impact studies, impact assessments, that kind of thing? Or are you thinking about if these organisms that synthetic biologists create, if they somehow get into the wild?
Yes, both of those things and more. And in a kind of more philosophical tone, when new life forms are created, which synthetic biology is doing, what role do those novel organisms play in relationship to all the existing life on Earth? In a sense, are we in the conservation community going to become responsible for looking after all of the new life forms that the synthetic biologists are creating?
Are you worried about that seriously as a sort of potential, you know, potential issue for as sort of the detritus of this stuff that comes out and affects the world out there?
Well, yes, I guess. There is a concept which was a new one to me called naked DNA. And it turns out that there's pieces of DNA lying around all over the place. We ourselves are shedding DNA constantly. And there are viruses and other organisms which pick up that DNA and can move it around and put it into the genomes of other animals and plants. So that is an existing, that is a natural phenomenon. So it's not that that's something that's created by synthetic biologists, but we need to think about what the impact of creating these new novel genetic sequences is going to be if they get introduced into the rest of the world.
How was your talk received by your audience of synthetic biologists?
So I gave a short version of the talk on the first day of the meeting, and it was received, I think, reasonably well. I had one young synthetic biologist come up to me and say, it's the first time anyone from the environmental community has ever had something good to say about the potential for her science to help the world.
Has there generally been negative responses before?
I'm new to this. I'm just getting started. I'm sure they're out there waiting to happen. Maybe it'll come as a result of this interview.
What else have you seen at the meeting that's inspired or surprised you?
I'm surprised by the extent to which people who are using engineering techniques are not thinking about the natural systems from which their parts are drawn. So that cells are spoken of as chassis, for example, which is a language use that distances yourself from the fact that it actually is a living organism that, in essence, you're killing in order to get what you want, and then you're rearranging its life. Now, I'm not going to say that I think we should all be responsible for the lives of individual bacteria, but it is something that should be worth at least thinking about.
Thank you very much, Kent.
My pleasure.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed our snapshot of synthetic biology research. It's a dynamic and fast-moving area of science, and I think you can hear it in the voices of our guests today and the buzz at Imperial College here in London, that it's a field that's just revving up. We'll have links to all the guests on today's show on our podcast blog. Just go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.